The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Hello, and welcome to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders. Today, thanks to audience requests, we're going to have a discussion about the Fukushima nuclear power plant accident. And to try and get a well-rounded perspective on that, we've invited two experts.
Welcome to Science for the People.
My first guest is Dr. Rob Tarswell, medical specialist with dual certification in psychiatry and nuclear medicine, and clinical assistant professor on the Faculty of Medicine at the University of British Columbia. Dr. Tarswell has a special interest in radiophobia, the irrational fear of radioactivity, and he engages in efforts to communicate the true risks and benefits of nuclear power to the general public. He's also the creator of the 1 Minute Medical School video series on YouTube. Welcome back, Rob.
Thanks for having me back.
My other guest today is Dr. Charles Ferguson, president of the Federation of American Scientists. Prior to joining FAS, Dr. Ferguson served as the project director of the Independent Task Force on U.S. Nuclear Weapons Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Previously, from 2002 to 2004, Dr. Ferguson had been with the Monterey Institute's Center for Nonproliferation Studies as its scientist in residence. At CNS, he co-authored the book, The Four Faces of Nuclear Terrorism, and was also lead author of the award-winning report, Commercial Radioactive Sources, Surveying the Security Risks, which was published in January 2003. From 2000 to 2002, he served as a physical scientist in the Office of the Senior Coordinator for Nuclear Safety at the U.S. Department of State, where he helped develop U.S. governmental policies on nuclear safety and security issues. He also published a book, Nuclear Energy, What Everyone Needs to Know, in May of 2011, just 2 months after the initial events at Fukushima. Thanks very much for being here, Charles.
Thanks for having me on the show, Rochelle.
Okay, to start out, give us some background on the Fukushima reactors. How do they work? How much energy do they put out? That kind of thing.
Well, these are actually old design reactors. I had also been a nuclear submarine officer in the U.S. Navy during the end of the Cold War. And so I have a little bit of experience in this kind of design. These are very compact reactors designed to fit within the volume of a submarine. They used a process called a boiling water reactor design. What that means is that water is actually allowed to turn into steam inside the reactor vessel, not right at the fuel rods. You want to keep that covered with liquid water, but the reactor is allowed to create the steam. The steam is then used to turn a turbine, which can make electricity with an electric generator. And so that's kind of the basic principle of how these reactors work. But with the Fukushima reactors, because they were based on these kind of submarine designs, they didn't have a lot of volume to capture that steam as the pressure built up. So when the reactors were shut down, when the earthquake struck, and so remember, first there was a huge earthquake, you know, about magnitude 9 on the Richter scale. Once that signal reached the nuclear plant, the reactors that were operating at the time, reactors 1, 2, and 3, shut down. Their control rods were inserted. So everything was going as planned. But then what happened is this massive tsunami wave struck the plant within an hour after the shutdown. And that flooded out the emergency diesel generators. They were in a vulnerable position. They were vulnerable to flooding. So then the plant lost its backup power. There was still battery power, but that didn't last very long. So within a day after the natural disaster struck, reactor unit number 1 was already starting to experience the phases of a meltdown. And so its core got damaged. Reactors 2 and 3 in the subsequent days, within that first week, we had 3 reactor meltdowns at Fukushima Daiichi. So this is unprecedented, where we had a nuclear accident where 3 reactors suffered core damage, meltdown, and release of radioactivity to the environment. You know, to put this in perspective, think about Chernobyl in 1986 when that accident happened. That was horrendous in terms of the contamination that was released, much more than from Fukushima. But that was just one reactor. And here in Fukushima, we had three reactors they had to contend with. And then there was also problems to deal with reactor unit number four, with the spent nuclear fuel that's being stored. And there were concerns that that was vulnerable as well. So, it's just unprecedented in terms of the magnitude of the crisis and what the workers had to deal with at that plant.
So you mentioned that these reactors were based off of a design previously used in submarines. How do they compare to other designs being used on land? Are there more of these sort of submarine-styled reactors installed on land?
There are. You know, here in the United States, where I'm speaking, or where I live, is we have about 23 of the U.S. reactors. So we have about 100 reactors now in operable status in the United States, the largest of any in the world. And almost one quarter of the reactors in the U.S. are of this kind of design. And so the events at Fukushima, have direct implications for these U.S. reactors. And so the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, right after the accident, they established a task force looking at what are the implications for the U.S.? And that was the first set of reactors they looked at. What requirements do we need to put in place in the U.S. reactors to make sure we don't see something like what happened at Fukushima?
So how did TEPCO, which was the company that maintained the reactors, respond?
It's a mixed record, to be diplomatic. The good side was that their workers seemed to be truly heroic. They stayed on station. They risked their lives, and in terms of radiation exposure, in terms of the stress they had to go under, in terms of isolation from their families. It was nonstop the media days after the accident. But I think on the bad side is that TEPCO has not been as transparent as they need to be with the public as to what's going on at the plant. We're still trying to puzzle out, how are they dealing with the contaminated water that keeps building up in more than 1,000 tanks on the nuclear site? They still have to develop a plan to deal with the spent fuel that's in reactor number four. That might be in a vulnerable condition. They also have to develop an effective plan how they're going to deal with the damaged reactor cores in units 1, 2, and 3. This is going to take many years to play out. If we look at what happened in the United States, in 1979 in Pennsylvania, not too far from where I grew up, was the Three Mile Island accident. And that was just one reactor, and it was just a partially damaged core. And that took several years to get under control and to finally remove that damaged core. So we're going to see a lot more technical challenges to deal with. But I think the main challenge you're facing right now is the more effective public communication. And I think Rob can probably speak to that better than I can in terms of what the public needs to know.
That's a really good question, Rob. What are your thoughts on that?
The public communication from TEPCO has been at times really problematic. Sort of the worst example of problematic communication that led to erosion of public trust was probably around the time of the Japanese general election, when TEPCO held on to news that after the early July discovery of some radiation in the groundwater about 30 meters from the shoreline of the inner harbor, they were asked, is any of this leaking into the harbor? And they had evidence that there was increased levels of tritium in the Fukushima inner harbor, but didn't disclose that until after the general election, which was won by the Liberal Democrats, who are a pro-nuclear party. That ended up leading to several senior executives getting docked pay and, of course, massive loss of public trust, which was already quite sketchy. TEPCO has a somewhat problematic record of being obfuscatory in terms of public communication and cover-up from the 60s and the 70s. So on the one hand, the workers are indeed working very hard containing the disaster, but there's just this issue with senior leadership and clarity and honesty of public communication, which then feeds into a very wary and, in fact, I would say significantly radiophobic Japanese press. And then when TEPCO makes the decision late July, okay, here's what we're going to do now. We're going to disclose everything. So then TEPCO turns around and falls on its sword at every opportunity it can. And so then we saw, for instance, after the 300-ton leak from July was properly contained, there was a puddle of radioactivity found within the 1,000 storage tank complex, and TEPCO released this like it was huge news, and this got relayed as, oh, you just stand near this puddle and you'll absorb a fatal dose of radiation within 2 hours. And there's no sort of moderation because they kind of squandered their trust.
When the meltdowns first happened, TEPCO seemed to have sort of insufficient numbers of proper detection equipment. It appeared as if they were caught entirely off guard by this. But according to news reports, it also seems like that's still the case 2 years later. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that is correct. I've talked to a CEO of a company that specializes in cleaning up from contaminated events, oil spills and nuclear accidents. And, you know, I won't mention his name here in this interview because I haven't got permission to do that. But, you know, I just on background, he's told me that when he's been over there with his crew on a number of occasions to try to help out with the cleanup, you know, he's been told that your instruments are faulty. You know, his radiation detection instruments were calibrated using standards here in North America, and he has the certificates to show it. And they in Japanese said no, you know, but he had differences in readings of factor of two or five, or you know, it was really significant differences in the readings. And you know, they were getting higher readings than the Japanese counterparts. So that's one issue. But then there's the issue of were there even enough detection instruments on hand? And I don't know that specifically, but what it doesn't surprise me if that were the case, because you know, what TEPCO and the other industry leaders were telling the Japanese public prior to the accident was, you know, nuclear power is very safe, extremely safe. You know, it's highly unlikely at all to have an accident, certainly not a major accident like they experienced. So I think the public was really taken off guard. If you looked at polls, and I don't put a tremendous stock in polls, but I think the polls in this case are illustrative. You know, prior to the accident, we had more than 2/3 of the Japanese public very supportive of nuclear power. And then right after the accident, it swung the other way. You know, well more than 2/3 were very against and wanted to shut down nuclear power. And you know, they were using cartoon characters and I think you know images from Alice in Wonderland and things of that sort, or you know, to convince school kids and their parents that nuclear power was something that was so safe, they didn't have to worry about having an accident. And you know, now it's you know, public is on the other end of the spectrum, and it's not surprising. So it's going to take, and this I think you know, here with Rob, I could segue back to him, is what's going to be needed to get the public get balance back into this discussion, get to really a healthy dialogue going. I'm not quite sure what that is, but I think it's needed.
Rob, any thoughts on what that step could be?
There are a few problems that have to be addressed. First, one thing that's interesting, in the immediate phase after the accident, this has just come out yesterday. Charles, I don't know if you saw this in Slate just as of yesterday, but a group of scientists from Lawrence Livermore right after the accident from the National Atmospheric Release Advisory Center, and this is a group that travels around looking at big scale atmospheric releases and potential implications to the public. The United States, of course, has large military bases in Japan, and the senior leadership at those bases after the accident was wondering, do we need to make plans to evacuate our U.S. citizens? And this team from Lawrence Livermore was dispatched to map out worst case scenarios. Atmospheric releases of radiation, could these have any impact on the U.S. bases, which would have been on the far side of Tokyo from the reactor complex in Fukushima? They ultimately determined that even in the worst case scenario of a complete meltdown, a complete breach, and absolutely horrible winds heading the wrong way, there is still no significant contamination risk to U.S. citizens. And at around the same time, the Atomic Energy Commission within Japan, there was a report released by the director, Shunsuke Kondo, where he more or less said the same thing. Both reports focused on the what they thought would be the main risk for meltdown, which would be the spent fuel rods from reactor 4 in a cooling pool. If that pool becomes damaged and the water level goes down, the potential exists for the rods to exceed their melting temperature with the potential for release of radioactive material into the environment. What he said in his report was that the potential area that could be affected has a radius of about 155 miles. And what the press interpreted that as is, oh, there's a potential that we're going to need to evacuate everything within 155 miles. Well, that, of course, includes Tokyo with 30 million people. And on top of this, a government employee who was responding to the report, Yukio Edano, who was a communication member for a government spokesman, talked about the possibility of, quote, a devil's chain reaction, unquote, based on just a gross misinterpretation of the report, no science at all. And the press ate this up. Now, at the same time, the Japanese press decided that what the Japanese officials were telling them was not trustworthy, whereas the American officials were giving them the unvarnished truth. That was based on a single email communication that was meant to be internal within the United States, which floated the possibility of a wide-scale meltdown and atmospheric release of radioactivity. Although what's interesting is by the time the Japanese government had gone into complete overreaction, the press was still wary of what they were saying. And so no matter what the Japanese said, the press assumed they're hiding something. It's got to be even worse than this. So these are the forces you're up against if you want to try and calm down the public discussion.
You're listening to Science for the People. And I'm talking to Dr. Charles Ferguson and Dr. Rob Tarswell about the Fukushima nuclear plant accident. So playing the hindsight game for a second, is there a better way TEPCO could have responded, or a better way the government could have responded to this, either sort of in containment or in public relations?
I think on the containment side, they have done and are continuing to doing, at least the employees on the ground, what they can do. And the problems seem to be at the level of communication. And this fault has included TEPCO, which I think finally has been chastened hard enough, particularly when the scandal broke about them sitting on information that could have had an influence on the Japanese election. And the government now has stepped in and is seen to have stepped in a larger way, saying, all right, this is beyond what an individual power company can handle. We are going to engage national level resources. I think those are important steps. And there is now, again, not only happening, but being seen to happen, the arrival of lots of foreign experts to lend expertise and technology in the effort.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with Rob's assessment. And you know, just to add to that, playing that hindsight game, it would have been great if the Japanese government would have taken control much earlier when they saw that TEPCO was not handling at least the communications side effectively. I talked just this spring to an American colleague who is a senior representative from a cleanup company, and he was at the Fukushima site for the first year and a half, and he's had a lot of experience in Japan. And so he can work well with them. They were able to get the kind of technology in place at Fukushima that would filter out the radioactive cesium. So there's the isotope cesium-137. You know, that's probably the most hazardous radioactive material that's resident in those reactor cores, and you want to keep that contained. And they've done a very good job actually containing that radioactive cesium. I think Rob earlier referred to tritium, this radioactive material. It's basically heavy hydrogen. It's a heavy form of hydrogen, has a half-life of about 12 years. It emits beta radiation. That's something that's extremely difficult to filter out. You know, that's probably the biggest problem right now in terms of the radioactivity resident in those 1,000 tanks there on site. But, you know, I think that they were brought in more of the foreign experts earlier, because there's a tremendous amount of expertise worldwide, certainly in the United States and Canada, and how to deal with these kinds of events. And they are bringing in these experts now. There's actually a call came out on September 25th by this new Institute for Reactor Decommissioning that the Japanese government set up in early August. And so they've sent out a request for proposals, especially for foreign companies, foreign experts, to help them come up with better solutions to dealing with the all these problems that they're trying to contend with on the site.
So I want to talk a little bit as well about the evacuees and sort of what went down there. There was actually an area around Fukushima that was evacuated, correct?
Yeah, about 300,000 people were evacuated. Unfortunately, in that evacuation process, there were 1,600 deaths, which is actually comparable to the 1,600 deaths from the earthquake. And epidemiologists have looked at that, and a recent study published in PLOS-1, Public Library of Science Journal, their flagship journal, concluded high mortality due to the initial evacuation suggests that evacuation of the elderly was not the best life-saving strategy for the Fukushima nuclear disaster. So, again, there was probably a role for some degree of evacuation, but the tendency has been a very large degree of government overreaction. And now it's thought to be the case that the evacuation itself has had a higher degree of mortality than if everyone had just been left alone and absorbed the radiation that was released into the environment.
You talk about the mortality of the evacuation. What kinds of ways did people die during this process?
There were folks who had mobility issues, being infirm and elderly. When buses were racing out of town, they were falling on the ground. There were problems managing food and water for these folks. There was the psychological stress of the evacuation. There was the psychological stress of thinking about what it is the reason they had been evacuated. So largely, the factors would have been the physical trauma of the evacuation, the privation of needs, and then the psychological factors would have been the biggest three.
Now, I understand some people have been allowed back into their homes and into parts of the evacuated area, but is it true that there are still an evacuated area where people haven't been allowed back yet?
I believe that's the case. Yeah, there are still some areas where the radiation level is approximately 20 millisieverts per year, and this is where we get into the weird world of nuclear protection regulations. This is a level that is beyond regulatory limits, but it's not clear that that's actually scientifically demonstrated to be a dangerous level to human health.
We agree with Rob that, you know, the 20 millisievert level, it's a very cautious level that was, you know, set by the International Committee Radiation Protection, ICRP. Canada, United States also kind of follow along with those standards. But I think Rob's absolutely right. There's not really a lot of good scientific evidence to really support that. It's still in the low-dose radiation regime. And there are places in the world where background radiation is even higher than that. And people are living healthy lives and not, you know, dropping dead because of exposure to this ionizing radiation.
So why are people being kept out then, I guess, just as a precaution?
Essentially, yeah, it's out of respect to regulatory limits, which are set extremely conservatively. And this comes from what's called the linear no threshold hypothesis of radiation exposure, meaning the premise of this hypothesis is that no radiation exposure is free of hazard, no matter how small. And therefore, the governing overall guiding principle of radiation safety is what's called ALARA, or as low as reasonably achievable. The idea being, if you can avoid one stray photon, you should avoid that one stray photon. And this leads to, under normal circumstances, this is a perfectly fine way to go about business. It's not really based on the evidence as we have it, because it's actually very hard to detect increased rates of cancer or genetic anomalies from very low levels of radioactivity. And in some cases, in certain species at super low levels of radioactivity, they actually seem to have what's called a hormetic effect, where they're actually healthier. And the reasons aren't fully understood, though it's thought to be related to improved DNA repair mechanisms, which get a boost from having to fix tiny little breaks in the DNA, which then sort of beefs up the system that defends against mutations, which therefore reduces the likelihood of cancer. And the linear threshold, or LNT hypothesis, says that since no level of radiation is safe, we have to set a level for workers that's so low that we are pretty sure that the irradiation they would absorb would put them at no increased occupational risk versus workers in comparable industries. And there are levels for that, which amount to approximately, depending where, what jurisdiction you're in, but these are pretty well aligned, between 50 and 100 millisieverts in a given year, and then, but no more than 100 over about a 5-year period. And then another, a lower level yet, is set for the public, which is generally the regulatory limit for the public is never meant to be more than 1 millisievert above background radiation. Now, just to put that into perspective, in most places around the world, background radiation is approximately 3.5 millisieverts per year. Regulatory limits state that exposure from other sources cannot be more than 1 millisievert per year on top of that. Meanwhile, there are certain places such as Kerala in India where the national background average is 100 to 200 millisieverts per year with no evidence of increased cancer risk in those populations.
This is Science for the People, and we'll be right back to talk more about the Fukushima nuclear plant accident after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders, and today we're talking about the Fukushima nuclear plant accident with Dr. Rob Tarswell, specialist in nuclear medicine, and Dr. Charles Ferguson, president of the Federation of American Scientists, who previously served as the project director of the Independent Task Force on U.S. Nuclear Weapons Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. So I want to sort of put this in perspective for people. The Fukushima accident has been compared both to Chernobyl and to the Three Mile Island incident. How does Fukushima compare to these two? What are sort of the similarities and what are some of the differences?
Well, I think in terms of similarities, I think probably Chernobyl is comparable, but in terms of radiation released, estimates are that the Chernobyl accident released probably 10 times the amount of radioactivity, radioactive materials that Fukushima released. And because of where the Fukushima plant is situated, right there on the coast of the Pacific Ocean, that a lot of that radioactive material did not necessarily land on land. Whereas in Chernobyl, the plant is deep in Ukraine and not far from the ocean. And so I think the Fukushima accident, in some sense, is comparable to Chernobyl because of if you look at the radiation released, but it's not nearly as damaging as from Chernobyl, because estimates are that more than 10 times the radioactivity was released from Chernobyl than from Fukushima. But in some sense, Fukushima is comparable to Three Mile Island because of the type of reactor. The reactors that were at Fukushima versus Three Mile Island versus Chernobyl, So Chernobyl had a type of design called a RBMK. It's in Russian, that means kind of, you know, Bolshoi reactor, large reactor, graphite moderated, water cooled. And it was really designed to make plutonium for weapons production. So that's that type of design came out of the more of the weapons program in the Soviet Union. Whereas the Fukushima plant design came out of the commercial industry and drawing from actually the U.S. Navy's design of boiling water reactors and pressurized water reactors designed for submarines, but then adapted to the commercial industry. So those reactors were, you know, designed to have containment structures to make sure that if there were an accident, that they could contain the radioactivity. Now, of course, we know that the radioactivity was not contained from the Fukushima reactors that were damaged, reactors 1, 2, and 3. And that's because the design was such that there wasn't enough volume to contain the steam buildup from the meltdown sequence. And so, you know, if they were able to actually bleed off that steam pressure effectively prior to the meltdown sequence, perhaps we could have averted a release of radioactivity or a lot of radioactivity to the environment from Fukushima. And you know, that was not the case. They didn't have the backup power available for a number of reasons. The plant was in a vulnerable condition. The emergency diesel generators got flooded out. They didn't have enough backup battery power at the site. And all the offsite power was knocked out because of the earthquake. So in some sense, Fukushima is unique. You know, almost every accident in some sense is unique. But there are kind of similarities in some sense to Chernobyl and similarities to Three Mile Island. But I think in some sense, Fukushima perhaps is the worst case nuclear accident the world has ever experienced in terms of having three reactors suffering a meltdown within a week and dealing with the you know, tremendous amount of problems still to be dealt with and the radioactivity that was released to the environment.
So that sounds kind of bad. So leaving aside for a second the people, the mortality rate of the evacuation itself, has anyone actually died as a result of the Fukushima accident?
There have been five deaths. None of them have been from acute radiation sickness. These were all deaths related to the earthquake and the flood and just industrial type accidents on the site in the weeks following the accident. And in the public, ongoing monitoring of radiation levels is occurring. And I believe it was July or August, a report hit the newspaper that an increased rate of thyroid nodules had been detected in children in the Fukushima population. It's not actually an increased rate of thyroid nodules. And the actual number of cancer cases they've detected is lower than what we would expect in a population of that size. And so far, there's been no evidence of iodine-131 accumulation within thyroid glands in the population around Fukushima. Iodine-131 is one of the short-lived, well, relatively short-lived, its half-life is 8 days, products of fission reaction. And after Chernobyl, what happened was in the countries that were honest about what had happened and rapidly distributed iodine tablets, and this is what iodine tablets are for, they're to block your thyroid by filling it up with non-radioactive iodine so that radioactive iodine is competing against a large iodine pool in your body and therefore is much less likely to get taken up by your thyroid gland. The nations that distributed tablets had no problem. The nations that didn't distribute tablets ran into a problem because iodine-131 got into clouds, which then rained down on grass, eaten by cows, concentrated into milk, and then fed to children. And after Chernobyl, there were approximately 7,000 more cases of thyroid cancer than would be expected. Although what's interesting is that there have been probably only about a dozen fatalities from those 7,000 cases, because children on the one hand are much more susceptible to thyroid cancer than adults, but they have a much higher rate of curability.
So maybe this is a good time to talk a little bit more about radiation's actual effect on the body. We've touched on it sort of here and there, but what actually sort of happens at different levels of radiation exposure?
You can essentially break the effects of radiation down into two camps. One are what we would call deterministic effects, meaning these are going to happen in a predictable sequence as you absorb increasing doses. And those would be the acute radiation sickness phenomenon. So as you get between, say, 500 to 1,000 millisieverts, you may experience nausea. You're going to experience a drop in your white cell count levels, which will be detectable with blood work. Once you get above, say, 2,000 millisieverts, then you're heading into more gastrointestinal type symptoms. And this is for total body absorption. So the possibility of diarrhea and nausea, vomiting, bloody dysentery, which of course is happening at the same time that you're losing white counts. You're having a breakdown in the intestinal barrier and therefore the potential for fecal bacterial contamination, which is what would be most likely to kill you in that lower dose range. And then as you get into the 6,000 to 7,000 millisievert range, you're starting to look at populations where there's about a 50% chance you're going to die without medical intervention, meaning antibiotics, rehydrating fluids, and things like that. And then once you're above about 7,500 to 8,000 millisieverts, death is inevitable. The next syndrome would be what we would call the central nervous system or neurological syndrome. And this is for a very high dose in the order of 100 sieverts or 100,000 millisieverts, where there's massive disruption of cell membranes, and individuals who experience that level of radiation absorption, unfortunately there have been few, will rapidly go into a delirium and then a coma, and death within hours to days is inevitable. Now, on the other side are what we call the stochastic effects, meaning they are random. The probability increases as the dose increases, but it's never determined. And also, the severity of the outcome is not related to the dose absorbed. So if you get a high dose of radiation, that doesn't mean you're going to get a worse cancer. It doesn't even mean you're going to get a cancer. It means you're going to get a higher probability of cancer. And that is approximately a 5% risk per 1,000 millisieverts absorbed. So for instance, if we go back to that 20 millisievert per annum range around Fukushima, if folks were to move back in there, we would expect that after 50 years of living in that environment, they would have a 5% increased risk of cancer. Now that needs to be compared against the general background rate of cancer, which is about 40%.
What about the effects on wildlife and the environment?
That I'm less familiar with, and you'd want to specifically ask a radiation biologist. But one thing I can say is that there was a hugely viral internet meme that came out in July showing photos that were allegedly of produce from Fukushima. And these spread like wildfire, showing really weird exotic plants that basically look like normal plants with tumors on them. And these photos were actually from several years ago from a completely different part of the world, I think Eastern Europe. But the cat's out of the bag, and Fukushima farmers who have perfectly safe produce have had absolutely rotten luck trying to sell the stuff because of enormous fear.
So we actually threw out an opportunity to ask questions to our Facebook page, and we did get a few back. One person asks, I've heard that one of the worst case scenarios is the potential collapse of a fuel storage bank. Is that a real issue?
Yeah, I think so. I think they're referring to what Rob and I have been talking about a couple of times in terms of reactor number 4. They have the spent fuel. That's the fuel that had been taken out of the reactor. So it's irradiated. It's radioactive. It's sitting in a pool of water. And the way these reactors are designed, the storage pools are at elevation. So they're above ground level. And that was done for kind of ease of refueling and defueling the reactors. But the concern is that if there were cracks or some kind of hole in those storage tanks, there's pools that the water could drain, the spent fuel could heat up and exceed its melting temperature and release radioactivity, radioactive materials to the environment. United States Senator Ron Wyden, he went to Fukushima about a year, year and a half ago, and he raised this concern. And there have been other outsiders who are saying that the Japanese government and TEPCO need to do more to kind of remove that spent fuel quickly as possible, put it into what are called dry storage casks, which are very safe and secure. And they have that technology in Japan. They have been using it to a limited extent, even at Fukushima site itself. They do have some dry cask storage capability. And so, you know, that's something I think should be done relatively soon. And there have been plans by next year, 2014, to remove that to spent fuel and put it in these dry storage casks. But, you know, something I would think in hindsight should have been done much earlier.
So what's the worst, I guess, sort of worst possible scenario there?
I think worst possible scenario would be a complete emptying of that spent fuel pool of water, and that the spent fuel resident there would heat up, and then you would have it maybe even catching fire. It depends on how old the fuel is, what's the decay heat. And, you know, so I think, but we're talking about kind of plausible worst case. You know, some of it could catch fire, and that could lead to the cladding material, which is made of the zirconium, that degrades, that exposes the radioactive materials, these fission products, and those could potentially be released from that reactor number 4 and get into the environment. And, you know, a lot depends on the age of the fuel, the heat of the fuel, the amount of radioactivity resident in that material. So it's hard to say right now, not knowing all those facts, you know, how much radioactivity could be released. And I think prior to that, if they're monitoring that spent fuel pool, and I think they are monitoring it, they see the water level going down, there are things they can do, you know, put fire hoses in there to keep the water filled up to make sure the spent fuel doesn't become uncovered. So I think even that worst case that I was outlining is very unlikely to occur. It's possible, but I don't think it's likely to actually happen.
This is Science for the People, and we'll be right back to talk more about the Fukushima nuclear plant accident after this.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're talking about how climate change is altering the face of the planet and affecting the lives of the people who live here. Desiree Schell speaks to science writer and naturalist Christopher White about his book, The Melting World, A Journey Across America's Vanishing Glaciers. And she's joined by sociology researcher Stephen Castles to discuss human migration and how it's being shaped by the shifting climate. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Welcome back to Science for the People. So there has been some contaminated water released or leaked. How much is that? How much water has actually been released?
It's an interesting question. The leak everyone's aware of is the 300-ton leak from one of the storage tanks. And 300 tons is about 1/8 of an Olympic swimming pool. And that the site of that leak is actually several hundred meters from the shoreline. We do know that there was the groundwater detection in July. I think that at this point, and Charles could, you know, correct me on this, I think they're reasonably sure that that was coming from water within cabling trenches running between the reactors, which then needed to be pumped out into tanks. And now they've built the break wall to prevent water from getting into the inner harbor. But what's interesting, the Fukushima harbor itself is actually in two stages. There's an inner harbor right by the reactor complex, which is essentially dammed off from the outer harbor, which has break walls that shield it from the Pacific Ocean. And so far, all the excess radiation detections from recent incidents have been in the inner harbor. So far, there's been no evidence that I'm aware of, or at least as of August, that there's been any increased radiation in the outer harbor or in the Pacific Ocean. In fact, in August, Fukushima Prefecture began opening public beaches for the first time since 2011.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with Rob. That tracks with what I've been reading. And I actually periodically get briefings from Japanese government officials, maybe take that with a grain of salt, but also independent experts. For instance, there's an American, Lake Barrett, who had been in charge of cleanup activities at Three Mile Island in the early 1980s. He actually has a very good and thorough piece on the website of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. So at thebulletin.org, people can read Lake Barrett's analysis. And I think it's a very thorough one, and he's one of the leading experts in the United States on this kind of issue.
So what about the rest of the contaminated water, the stuff that's still contained? What happens with that?
Well, it's going to, there are, as we've been mentioning, there are about 1,000 tanks full of contaminated water, and many of these tanks, they're getting at capacity. They're 80% or more full. Really, the tricky thing to take out is this tritium, which is heavy hydrogen that's radioactive. That's going to be hard to filter out. Filtering out things like radioactive cesium, cesium-137 with a 30-year half-life, and it emits gamma radiation, that a lot of that filtering has already been occurring, and most of that has been removed, I'm led to understand. But then there's also the question of strontium-90, which is a beta emitter, and you don't want that to get into your body because if it gets resident in your bone, it's hard to remove. It has similar chemical properties as calcium, and we know calcium collects in bones. Strontium-90 has about a 29-year half-life. So that's another one of the fission products that they have to really pay attention to. You know, really from a technical standpoint, it would almost make sense to take a lot of that water and kind of spread it around the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Now, that's probably not going to happen for a number of reasons, because Japan has been a leader in preventing the dumping of radioactivity in the world's seas and oceans. There's a convention called the London Convention Against Dumping, and Japan was very concerned back in the time of the Cold War and immediately after the Cold War when the Russians were decommissioning all their nuclear submarines. And they wanted to make sure that the Russians weren't just going to dump it out into the Sea of Japan. And, I worked on this when I worked for the U.S. Department of State about 12 years ago. And I remember Japanese officials coming to my office and saying, in a very polite way, but insistent way, put pressure on the Russians not to dump this material. They need to make use of these technologies that the Japanese actually provided the Russians to clean up the contaminated water from these submarines. So it's kind of ironic in a way, unfortunate, that Japan is now dealing with a much bigger problem at the Fukushima site.
By dumping, so you sort of talked a little bit about maybe the best possible scenario was to sort of just dump it in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. So I guess that means that the amount of it and the amount of potential radiation within it isn't kind of going to have a huge impact on the wildlife, given the size of the Pacific Ocean?
Yeah. If you wanted to come back to a sense of scale, there's a last that I heard about 330,000 tons of contaminated water in the storage tanks. And let's say in a worst case scenario, all of that ended up in the Pacific Ocean. Well, the Pacific Ocean actually already has tritium in it. This is constantly being produced from cosmic ray bombardment. And so actually one thought has been that once the water has been stripped of heavier fission products, that it could be diluted and discharged into the Pacific. But to get a sense of scale, it'd be like dumping a barrel of ink into Lake Superior. It's not going to change the color of the lake. It's, in fact, once it gets maybe more than a few hundred yards, certainly a mile out from where you dump it, it's so dilute that it has no significant impact as a health hazard. And there was an interesting model published recently from the initial reactor discharge and cool down, which demonstrated that by 4 years, there would be approximately 10 becquerels per liter of radiation that had originated in Fukushima in the seawater. Compared with what's already there, though, that is almost a meaningless amount of radiation. Just for comparison, a kilogram of instant coffee has radioactivity of about 1,000 becquerels. So this is an incredibly tiny amount of radiation. You'd need to drink a substantial part of the ocean for that to be a human health hazard.
What's the anticipated global impact on humans in the next 10 or 25 or, say, 50 years?
Zero.
I'd have to agree with that, too. I mean, based on what we know of the science and what Rob was saying, yeah, I think it's negligible. It's almost unmeasurable. It's going to be in the, buried in the noise.
So those are, I'm assuming, the health impacts. Now, what about some of the political fallout we've seen? Because certainly it's a bad press day for nuclear energy.
Yeah, and this is the unfortunate part. Japan has, there's of course increasing pressure to abandon nuclear power in Japan. There's been a response in Germany to stop production of nuclear power. Well, energy hunger isn't going away. And where do you turn to get that level of energy in a hurry? You go back to fossil fuels. So the anti-nuclear lobby, on the one hand, is, quote, winning, but the price we're paying is going to be an enormous surge in carbon burden in an already very heavily fossil fuel dominated electrical production worldwide. I think about 68 or 70% of electric production in the world is already fossil fuel, and only about 15% is nuclear.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I would have to agree with Rob again that that's what we're seeing. That there's been a nuclear slowdown. There's a very comprehensive report that Michael Schneider issues every year. He's, you might imagine by his name, he's German, and he maybe has a tendency to be kind of anti-nuclear, but he has a very balanced report, and they look at what's the trend of the industry. And it's been a slowdown. So there's been all this talk, especially last decade, about a so-called nuclear renaissance. But reality is that except for China and the United Arab Emirates and the United States, where we have a couple of reactors now being built, it's not at the pace that you would need to build reactors just to replace the plants being retired. I did an analysis a few years ago for Foreign Policy magazine looking at how fast you would need to build reactors and bring them online just to take a 1/7 reduction in the projected greenhouse gas emissions, carbon emissions in particular. And you would have to bring online one large 1,000 megawatt electric power reactor every 2 weeks in order to keep pace with that kind of reduction of carbon emissions that you'd want to achieve from nuclear. And then you would need a whole other suite of technologies to try to flatten that curve, that carbon emissions curve. And just to keep pace with the amount of electricity demand that's projected worldwide, especially in the developing world, you would need to bring online one large reactor every 3 to 4 weeks. And we're not anywhere near that kind of pace. So I'm not trying to say that nuclear power is the answer. There's nothing as the solution. There's no cure-all. We're going to need a whole suite of technologies that are near zero carbon emission or very low carbon emission sources. And, we just haven't shown the seriousness of doing that.
So we're almost out of time, but I do want to touch briefly on thorium reactors for a minute, because they have sort of popped up around this issue. Can someone give me a fairly brief overview about how they work and what the advantages and disadvantages would be?
Thorium is a material, is an element that is not fissile in itself or fissionable. It has to be turned into something that's fissionable. So the type of reactors or technologies to make use of thorium, you would have to have some type of production of neutrons that get absorbed by the thorium nucleus and nuclei, And then that turns into uranium-233, which is very fissile. And then that can be fissioned, and you can make electricity out of that reaction. And so there are a number of different thorium reactor designs. In terms of the advantages, a number of these designs are claimed to be more proliferation resistant than a traditional uranium-fueled reactor, in that if you look at the types of materials coming out of the reactor in the spent fuel, it's very less desirable to make a nuclear bomb out of that kind of material. Whereas if you look at the spent fuel coming out of the Fukushima reactor or reactors in Canada and the United States, this has material in it, plutonium, that could be harvested through reprocessing technologies and separated out, and you can make nuclear weapons out of that plutonium. And so that's why the thorium fuel cycle is very attractive to a lot of people, especially people who don't want further proliferation of weapons technologies, but who are supportive of further use of nuclear energy.
Any drawbacks to this system?
Well, the commercial viability. The uranium-fueled reactor kind of system is so entrenched that it's very hard to have a new type of technology like thorium to get into the marketplace. I know a CEO of a company, I'll mention it because he's very, very public about it. His name is Seth Gray. Seth, about 20 years ago, out of law school, he founded a company called Thorium Power. So he was trying to actually commercialize the use of thorium in nuclear power. And it was very frustrating, very challenging. They've done a lot of very interesting R&D, and they weren't able to make inroads in the uranium industry. So actually now they've rebranded their company, and they're called Lightbridge. And they're doing more and more work on the uranium fuel cycle rather than thorium. They have a lot of work kind of on the back burner with thorium, but they haven't been able to really figure out how to get it commercialized. So I think that's really, in my view, the kind of the main barrier to thorium right now.
There seems to be a little bit of disagreement as well as to whether or not a thorium reactor is sort of technologically feasible even.
That's true. And I think that probably gets at why, you know, former companies like Thorium Power weren't able to get it up to the commercial level. I think there's been a lot of promising work at the very R&D level, certainly the computer simulations and some of the some kind of lab work. But there's a big gap, a big gulf between that and actually getting something that's commercially viable. In terms of countries out there that are trying to really leverage their use of thorium resources, India has about a third or more of the known thorium resources in the world. They've had plans going back to the early 1950s to eventually have thorium be the primary source of their electricity production. And so to get there from here is going to still require a tremendous amount of scientific and engineering research and investment. And I think they're still decades from actually getting there.
All right. So last words, is there anything we missed or anything you would like to leave our listeners with?
I would say don't give up on nuclear power, but be skeptical, too, and ask these probing questions. And it's been a delight to be on the show and to really focus on the science and technology, what we know and what we don't know. And there's really no perfect solution in terms of how to provide for our energy needs. There are risks and benefits for any energy source. And I think nuclear power can play a role. And I would hope that we would learn the right lessons from Fukushima, especially and how to be open with the public and to be open to their concerns and not just say, don't worry. These things are very safe.
Thank you very much to both of you for being here today.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
You can find links to both Dr. Ferguson and Dr. Tarswell on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to Twitter, Facebook, Google+, and iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People.
Thank you. Science for the People is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our promotions manager. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. K.O. Myers updates our website. Helen Quivillion is our publishing liaison. Ed Haynes is our guest coordinator. We get research help from Josh Witten. The show is edited by K.O. Myers and Ryan Bromsgrove. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Rochelle Saunders, Marie-Claire Shanahan, and me, Desiree Schell.